It's obvious that a lot of the church got the email that announced that I was going to be teaching class. But that's kind of the way things are some days. Glad you're all here this morning. As I look around the auditorium, I see kind of as I expected that there's a lot of people with a lot of experience in life in the audience. Doesn't that sound like a lot better than saying there's a lot of old people, Cynthia? A lot of experience in life. Yeah, and we have had a lot of experiences. And even some of you younger folks even share in some of the experiences that we as older people have had. And I was just thinking, how many of us not saw a picture or not heard about, but actually had and used a rotary dial phone? Okay. And how many actually had and watched a black and white TV? In fact, I can remember when I didn't have a TV. And certainly most of us were around long before the internet was invented. But I know for sure that all of us have lived with one long-lasting constant. The leading cause of death in the United States has been the same all during our lifetime. And what would that leading cause of death in the United States be? Heart disease, cardiovascular disease. That was followed by cancer and tobacco-related illnesses, and then infectious diseases like AIDS and HIV, they came on the picture. But not anymore. The leading cause of death in the United States and the world in 2025 was abortion. Worldwide, 73 million babies have been killed by dismembering, suctioning, poisoning, or starving them to death in their mother's womb. Life News reports that almost 52% of deaths worldwide were from abortion. The World Health Organization reports that every day in the United States, 1,500 to 2,500 babies are killed by abortion. Worldwide, that number is 115,000 each day. The Guttmacher Institute, this needs to work. The Guttmacher Institute reports that 20% of all pregnancies, excluding miscarriages, end in abortion. That's almost 1 million abortions a year in the United States. And conservative estimates reveal that approximately one-third of women in America either have had or will have an abortion sometime in their lives. 1 in 3. Now that ought to get our attention. Add to that that the chemical abortion pill that was only approved for use in 2000 and has not been readily accessible since 2023, those pills are responsible for 70% of all the abortions. And even though the FDA and the EPA have not extensively studied the environment, the environmental impact of these pills, they know that over 40 tons of chemically tainted human waste have been flushed into our waterways each year. Last week, the report came out that upped that number to 50 tons of chemically tainted human remains. And all the numbers that and figures that we'll talk about through this series are, with each new report, each new study, are going upward. From the Truth Rising series, that documentary that we ended 2025 with, you'll remember that Oz Guinness said that we are in a civilizational moment, and that's when a society becomes detached from the essential truths that have rooted it and grounded it, and it declines and dies. So as things are now in the West, we cannot survive. Our culture cannot survive. When an entire civilization abandons the ideals that have nourished it, there are consequences. And that's why practically every civilization that you can name is the subject of a history book. The history books tell us that those civilizations died, and they may even tell us why they died, but they don't tell us what it means for us to be called to a pivotal place in time and history, and how that we should live during that pivotal time. We have to decide whether we will be agents of renewal or participants in our decline. Remember, it's not an accident that we are alive at this particular time and place. How are we going to handle God's calling? You know, we aren't called just to exist or survive. And it was no accident that the apostles were alive at the exact place and time of Jesus' ministry. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record that when the apostles received the call from Jesus, they immediately dropped their nets and followed him. Our question this morning is, have we dropped our nets? Over the next few sessions, we're going to take a deep dive into the abortion issue. And I expect that some of you won't agree with what is presented. And some of you may be asking yourself, why are we studying a cultural issue rather than a religious issue? Well, the destruction of human life is a cultural issue, and there is a need to reform our culture's view of who we are and how we treat the unborn. If we don't turn the way the majority, and I underline majority, of our culture thinks about abortion, it will be one more step toward the collapse of our great society. Granted, we might not bring one soul to Christ. We might not baptize one individual through our efforts to stop the killing of the unborn. However, we might stop the killing of the unborn. Our discussion of abortion might not fit the Great Commission. You might argue that we aren't focusing on preaching the gospel. And cultural reform can't get a man to heaven, but that doesn't mean that it cannot save him from injustice in this life. For example, our work with the Barnabas Ministry is designed to help the weak, the less fortunate, the needy in our community. And we get a really high grade for that mission. But if you grade us on the number of baptisms coming out of Barnabas, we get a pretty low grade. Does that mean that we need to stop Barnabas? Well, I don't think so. Another important point is that cultural reform, is that cultural reform is not necessarily about changing the hearts of individuals. It is more about restraining their evil acts. Martin Luther King put it this way: it may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important. Romans 13, 1 through 4 says the purpose of government is to preach is to restrain the evil acts that we do to each other. Now, we know that the primary purpose of the church is to preach the gospel. But if Christians do not also challenge government to fulfill its duty to protect the weak and the defenseless, who will? You know, Christians were at the center of the battle to abolish slavery in our country. Christians were at the center of the battle for civil rights. Would our culture have been better off if those Christians had focused just on preaching the gospel and ignored the evils of slavery and social injustice? Probably not. And finally, does being a pro-life advocate detract from one's ability to go and make disciples? What better tool to help rescue the innocent than the gospel? Maybe in our efforts to be witnesses for Jesus, in our efforts to make disciples, we ought to pay more attention to addressing cultural issues. Who better to handle them than God's children? As I was researching and studying for this class, I sought out recommendation on how best to present the topic of abortion in a class setting like this. And I was surprised that over and over, the same recommendation on how to introduce the topic appeared from multiple sources. And that recommendation was to share pictures and videos of abortion so that the severity of abortion would be understood by the class. Some of you probably have seen some of those pictures and videos. But whether you have or not, I want you to know that I am not going to follow that recommendation and show you those pictures or videos. I've seen some pretty gruesome stuff, including my time in Vietnam, and I just want you to know that watching a video of a baby being cut up in his mother's womb and removed in pieces is much worse than anything I ever saw in Vietnam. And you are all intelligent people, and I'm not going to turn your stomachs by showing you those pictures and those videos. I just feel like that our discussion and the other material that will be presented over the next few weeks is going to reveal the same story that those pictures, no matter how true they are just gruesome. So, let's get started. And as you can already tell, me and this clicker and the PowerPoint are not a well-oiled machine. So if there's not continuity with what I'm saying and what you're seeing, just shake your head and pray for me, okay? I assure you that I'm not wanting to provoke controversy just for controversy's sake, and I certainly don't want to condemn anyone. We should want to get to the truth. And I'll do the very best job that I can of doing that. Our goal is to present the truth, to equip you with information and tools that you will need to talk with those who are struggling with what to believe about abortion, or to argue with those who are enemies of the unborn. Our discussion over the next few weeks will be based on an understanding of God's teaching about who we are as His creation and what that understanding requires of us as Christians. In 1968, the Supreme Court ruled that it was okay to dismember a human child in his mother's womb at any stage of pregnancy and for any reason. That case, you'll recognize Roe versus Wade, became an easy excuse for why Americans, especially American Christians have let the killing of innocent babies go on for decades. If we ever really had an excuse, we lost it in 2022 when Roe was reversed. That reversal meant that the 9 unelected Supreme Court justices could no longer have the sole legal authority to determine abortion policy. Instead, individual states now decide how the practice of abortion is governed. In other words, the American people, your friends, your coworkers, your family members now decide if unborn human beings enjoy the same legal protections as you and me. Now, we know that the reversal of Roe didn't fix everything, did it? Putting abortion in the hands of the states, in the hands of the people, has shown that the biblical view, the Christian worldview of God's relationship with the unborn is more and more at odds with what our culture believes to be true. In fact, of the 8 states that have voted on abortion since Roe was overturned, all 8 have approved abortion. And to add to that story, and to reinforce that the majority of people in the United States and our culture oppose the Christian view of God's relationship with the unborn, I found this report just a week or so ago. An Indiana judge has ruled that limiting abortion violates the freedom, get this, the freedom of religion. Now listen to this report. Listen to this report. Okay, it's not going to play. I'll just tell you. A suit was brought in the Indiana court, and it said that putting limits on abortion.
Welcome to Breakpoint, a daily look at an ever-changing culture through the lens of unchanging truth. For the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street. Earlier this month, an Indiana judge blocked a pro-life law arguing that limiting abortion violates the freedom of religion. The claim, brought by the American Civil Liberties Union and Hoosier Jews for Choice, argued that an Indiana law, and I quote, violates religious freedoms by burdening the ability to obtain an abortion in accordance with sincerely held beliefs, end quote. Judge Christina Kleinman agreed with the argument, saying this, quote, the court finds there's significant public interest in ensuring the religious freedom of all citizens, and the state's position that religious freedom is somehow less important than other exceptions in the abortion law puts the court in an untenable position and finds a permanent injunction the only proper relief, end quote. The ACLU, which does not typically champion religious rights, responded by saying this, today's ruling is a recognition that religious freedom protects people of many faiths and beliefs, not just those favored by the state. For more than 3 years, our clients have challenged a law that forces them to choose between their faith and their autonomy. Of course, asserting a religious right to kill kids is a diabolical attempt to be clever. And yet, twisting the state's Religious Freedom Restoration Act is more than just rhetorical snark. It indicates just how dramatically the conversation about abortion has shifted in recent years, even as imaging technologies and prenatal medicine has clarified what the practice really is. You see, not that long ago, politicians would campaign on the idea that no one really wants abortion, but women need it in extraordinary circumstances. Today, abortion's celebrated with light shows and dance parties as if it's a moral good and any restrictions are a fundamental violation of human rights. It used to be safe, legal, and rare. Today, it's shout your abortion. And pro-abortion propaganda has become even more radical just as the political climate increasingly favors abortion. In the years since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, so-called abortion rights have been enshrined in the constitutions of numerous American states. with rare exceptions, when voters are given the chance to curb abortion in their states, they just fail to show up. The GOP, once a pro-life party, now openly endorses chemical abortion and unregulated IVF, the two most common ways that preborn children are killed in America. In other words, abortion's not merely a plank in the Progressive Party platform. It's the chief commitment of a worldview that now dominates America. It's for many a sacrament to recognize and enshrine and honor autonomy. Abortion's not merely a legal right, R-I-G-H-T, of a decadent society. It is a right, R-I-T-E, of worship, specifically a way to worship the idols of self, sex, and state. Abortion is not, nor has it ever been, merely a matter of public policy. Certainly, the politics of abortion is an essential place for us to take a stand. However, as the performative marches and handmade outfits demonstrate, abortion's always been at heart a worldview issue. As important as legal victories are, the goal has to be for abortion to become as unthinkable as the great social evils of history, like slavery and genocide. But what we're seeing is not only that abortion is thinkable, it's actually being revered as a symbol and a right of a terrible religion. That's why the loudest advocates for abortion claim that people cannot have authentic life without access to it. Of course, that...
Did you get that? You can't have authentic life without access to abortion. Abortion is a religious right. Do you see a problem there? People in the United States and to some degree the United Kingdom and Canada are having a huge worldview argument over two quick key questions that will impact you and your children and your grandchildren for decades to come. And how we answer those two questions will do nothing less than determine the future of human beings. First, we're arguing about truth. We've been talking about truth since the Truth Rising series. Is moral truth real and knowable, or is it just a preference, like choosing chocolate ice cream over vanilla? Second, we're arguing over human value. Are you and I valuable for who we are intrinsically, or only for what we can functionally do? The question of truth and the question of human value are driving our national debates on abortion, on cloning, and on embryonic stem cell research. The debates are contentious because they involve deeply held worldview commitments that get to the heart of who and what we are as people. But the debate itself is really not all that complex. Either you believe that each and every human being has an equal right to life, or you don't. The abortion issue is becoming a worldview fight. And I say fight, but I'm not sure it's a fair fight. Not many Christians have the information or the facts or the will to fight, to make a stand for babies in the womb. Very few churches have the fortitude to take a pro-life stand. I'd be willing to bet that there's not another church in Texas or Oklahoma that's starting a discussion about abortion this morning. But the failure of churches and preachers to talk about abortion is not something new. It's not a new phenomenon. Scott Klusendorf, an author and nationally known speaker and leader in the pro-life movement, tells this story in his book, A Case for Life. Klusendorf states that in spite of pro-life's win with the Supreme Court, we are falling far short in our churches and our Christian schools. He says the problem is He says the problem is not messaging, it's access. For many Christian leaders and gatekeepers, the thought of pro-life teaching is dead on arrival. He continues, anyone who doubts me on that should visit Summit Ministries. Each summer, Summit runs regional worldview conferences in places like Colorado, Arizona, and Georgia. The purpose of these conferences is simple. Prepare Christian students for the intellectual challenges that they will face once they leave the safety of their local church and step onto the university campus. Klusendorf writes, I teach the abortion sessions at Summit. For the last 8 summers, I've conducted an informal survey of the attendees, and I asked for a show of hands on a specific question. How many of you, prior to coming to Summit, have heard a pro-life apologetics presentation in your church aimed at equipping you to defend the pro-life view to your unchurched friends? The numbers have improved slightly of late, but overall, they are remarkably 1,800 students present each summer. An average of only 75 have prior exposure to a pro-life apologetics presentation in their church. That's 75 out of 1,800. That's 2.8%. And churches aren't the only challenge. Life Training Institute, now it's getting ahead of me. Life Training Institute, where Klusendorf is the president, trains Christians to make a persuasive case for life in the public square. And the primary way that they fulfill their mission is by making pro-life presentations to Catholic and Protestant high schools. Those presentations focus on why the pro-life view is true and reasonable to believe. And it takes a Herculean effort and a lion's share of their budget to get in front of the Catholic and Protestant high school students. Many private schools, mostly which you know are religious, ignore them, even though their presenters are top quality. And knowing that most Christian schools are broke anyway, they will send their speakers for free. But even that, they still have trouble getting access. Klusendorf concludes by writing, put simply, our problem is not subject matter. We're offering an abortion presentation that many Christian schools and churches don't want. And we shouldn't assume that Christian students are going to get their pro-life teaching from some national evangelical thought leaders when some of the most influential ones consider pastoral silence a theological virtue. And this also has been true for a long time. One of the most famous and influential preachers of our time, Billy Graham, told talk show host Larry King on his show in 1994 that addressing abortion in a pulpit could impede his main message of salvation. I don't get into things like abortion, Graham said. Now jump forward 30 years or so to the present day. David Platt is currently preaching at the McLean Bible Church, which is a mega church in the Washington, D.C. and surrounding Virginia suburbs. And you've probably seen some of his lessons in Right Now Media. They have several topics by Platt, including his Secret Church series that Platt put together after he had spent some time teaching believers in Asia who had to worship underground because of governmental persecution. He's also an author, and a particular book I'll mention is entitled Counterculture, following Christ in an anti-Christian age. And in Counterculture, he addresses several topics with the purpose of encouraging Christians to not retreat, to take the risk to live out their faith amid significant destructive social issues of our culture. And for the majority of his life and his church ministry, Platt says that he viewed abortion as a political issue about which he had no need to be personally concerned. He states, "I failed to realize that abortion is a biblical issue about which I had great need to be deeply concerned." And for all the pressing issues that he brings up in Counterculture, abortion poses the most clear and present danger for the most people on a daily basis. But I want you to hear his words. These are his words when he describes his former attitude about abortion in private and from the pulpit. He says he was shamefully silent and appallingly passive. So it's no wonder that the majority of our young adults and our kids don't have a pro-life worldview. And I want to remind you of our mission. It's to get to the truth, to equip you with the information and tools you will need to talk with those who are struggling with what to believe about abortion, and to argue with those who are enemies of the unborn. And you have to understand that the key to being successful, and we want to be successful in these discussions, the key to being successful is clarity. Opponents will throw all kinds of phony information and appeals to try to change the subject. So as we move forward, it's critical that we always stay anchored in the core of the pro-life argument. And that core is best expressed in this syllogism. And a syllogism is a form of deductive reasoning that consists of a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. So the core, the syllogism of the pro-life argument, first is, it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Second, abortion intentionally kills innocent human beings. Therefore, abortion is morally wrong. So let's say that again. The core of the pro-life argument is that it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Abortion intentionally kills innocent human beings. Therefore, abortion is morally wrong. Whenever the opposition in your discussions present an argument that doesn't fit this syllogism, they're trying to change the topic. Don't let them change the topic. So what do we mean when we say abortion is wrong? Abortion is wrong is an objective moral claim, not a subjective one. Subjective claims are about what you like, what you prefer. For example, flavors of ice cream. I like ice cream. I prefer chocolate. If you don't, you're wrong. No. That's a choice. That's what I prefer. That's a subjective claim. An objective claim is about what is morally true regardless of likes or preferences. When we say abortion is wrong, we're saying it's wrong regardless of anyone's personal tastes or preferences. It's not a subjective claim. And just in case there needs to be a definition of abortion, I'll refer you back to our syllogism. Abortion is the intentional killing of an innocent human being. And that abortion is the intentional killing of an innocent human being is even acknowledged by many who practice abortion and or defend the practice of abortion. Warren Hearn is an abortionist and an author of the book Abortion Practice. That is the standard medical text that teaches abortion procedures. And he made the following statement to a Planned Parenthood conference. He says, "We have reached the point in this particular technology, dilation and evacuation abortion, where there is no possibility of denying an act of destruction. It is before one's eyes. The sensations of dismemberment flow through the forceps like an electric current." In an article entitled "Fresh Blood for the Vampire," feminist Camille Paglia writes this: "I have always frankly admitted that abortion is murder, the extermination of the powerless by the powerful. Liberals, for the most part, have shrunk from facing the ethical consequences in their embrace of abortion, which results in the annihilation of concrete individuals and not just a clump of insensate tissue." In a dissenting opinion in the 2000 Supreme Court case, Stenberg versus Carhart, former Justice Anthony Kennedy made this statement: "The fetus, in many cases, dies just as a human adult or child would. It bleeds to death as it is torn limb from limb. The fetus can be alive at the beginning of the dismemberment process and can survive for a time while its limbs are being torn off." I don't think we need any pictures, do we? As early as 1970, an editorial in the medical journal California Medicine conceded that abortion kills a living human being and that claiming otherwise was intellectually dishonest. So even the people who perform abortions or teach those who perform abortions admit they are killing innocent human beings. This was in the news in the last couple of weeks, just to provide something that's fresh and new. Christina Applegate published her memoirs, her new memoirs. She was 19 years old and preparing to have an abortion, and I want to read to you from her memoirs. She says, "I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant and I'm killing my child on Thursday. Where can I go to recuperate from murder?" And then later in her memoir, she's talking to the child. "Hello, little thing. I feel you every moment of my day. Such a tiny existence, such an immense effect you have. You are a miracle, a tiny-handed miracle. I love you, but you know your fate. It's not your time. And I know you didn't make that decision, but it can't be your time. You will live on, though. You'll live on through another. I hope you will forgive me, but Mommy can't be with you right now. But no, she loves you more than any miracle." That was obviously hard to read. But it's one thing to support abortion of something that you think is not a living being, but it's another thing to actually acknowledge it as living and to say you're going to kill it. When it comes to abortion, many Christians don't know what to say. In a conversation about abortion, you might get caught off guard and know the other person is wrong, but you don't have the tools to defend your convictions. Or you may be with a group of friends and you don't want to say something that stirs up a hornet's nest. So to start, we're not going to try to memorize answers to every objection to the pro-life argument. It's important for us to know and focus on one question. What is the unborn? We can't really answer the question, can we kill the unborn, until we can answer the question, what is the unborn? This is a key question we all must answer. What is contained in the womb? Virtually every other question in the argument about abortion comes back to this question. Who or what is in the womb? Once this question is answered, everything else comes into perspective. And there really is no mystery about this question. The science of embryology establishes a set of facts about the developing human. Legal scholar and philosopher Robert George says, these facts are stubborn. There is no running away from them. Human embryos are not creatures different in kind from human beings like rocks or potatoes or alligators. They are, rather, human beings, distinct living members of the species Homo sapiens at the earliest stages of their natural development. They differ from human beings at later developmental stages, not in virtue of the kind of entity they are, but rather by degree of development. Leading embryology textbooks affirm this. In chapter 1 of The Developing Human, Clinically Oriented Embryology, authors Keith Moore, T.V.N. Persaud, and Mark Torchia, and I probably butchered their names, write, human development Human development begins at fertilization, when a sperm fuses with an oocyte to form a single cell, the zygote. This highly specialized totipotent cell, capable of giving rise to any cell type, marks the beginning of each of us as a unique individual. We've known these basic scientific facts for years. As early as 1868, Dr. Horatio Storer, who was the head of the American Medical Association's Committee on Criminal Abortion, confidently stated that physicians have now arrived at the unanimous opinion that the fetus in utero is alive from the very moment of conception and is therefore the willful killing of a human being at any stage of its existence is murder. In 1981, a U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee heard expert testimony on when human life begins. Professor Matthews Roth of Harvard University Medical School told the subcommittee, "It is incorrect to say that biological data cannot be decisive. It is scientifically correct to say that an individual human life begins at conception." To the same Senate subcommittee, Dr. Watson Bowes of the University of Colorado Medical School stated, "The beginning of a single life, human life, is from a biological point of view a simple and straightforward matter. The beginning is conception." That Senate subcommittee later concluded that physicians, biologists, and other scientists agree that conception marks the beginning of the life of a being that is alive and is a member of the human species. There is overwhelming agreement on this point in countless medical, biological, and scientific writings. So, you didn't come from an embryo. You once were an embryo. At no point in your prenatal existence, in your prenatal development, did you undergo any kind of substantial change or change of nature. You began as a human being and will remain so until death. Sure, you lack maturity at the early stage of your life, as does an infant. but you were human nonetheless. And I think I've run out of time, basically, I think, telling me. So, we're laying a foundation. Next week, we'll continue to build on that foundation and go forward. Thank you for being here.